Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to our Rabbis on the Run series. I know we're a little bit out of whack tonight, both because we're not on a Tuesday night, we're on a Wednesday night, and because we are in a different room as we welcome the Winter Kollel. I want to first thank our sponsors again for the entire series. They're right here. Lenny and Chani Grunstein, in memory of their fathers, Morris Grunstein and Aaron Tambor. Our learning should continue to be an aliyah for their neshamas. We appreciate the sponsorship very, very much. I also want to give a public debt of gratitude to Rabbi Kasorla. Many of you heard him last week. He's amazing. He's energetic. Someone was just telling me how much they enjoyed it. Little do you know that Rabbi Kasorla was asked to give that class at very last minute. I was, of course, supposed to give last week. I was not able to give last week. And instead of canceling, I said, you know what? Let me just ask Rabbi Kasorla. Maybe he's ready a little bit early. Sure enough, behold, he was ready a little bit early. And he was able to jump in at the last second and teach. So again, I want to publicly thank him for everything that he does, and in particular for him jumping in at the last moment last week. Okay, this week we have a great opportunity to learn about the Rebbe of Rizhin, Rav Yisrael Friedman of Rizhin. Now, what's interesting about the Rebbe of Rizhin, and we'll get into this a little bit, is the fact that much of Chassidus descends from him. So many of the dynasties that we're going to know and that are going to be familiar to us are going to be a descendant from him. And so in many ways, while we view the Maggid of Mezrich and some of those names as really the father of Chassidus, when we talk about the names, the dynasties that we're familiar with, it is really the Rebbe of Rizhin. Now obviously we're going to talk about the Rebbe of Rizhin's life, but this is a Rabbis on the Run series, and primarily we're going to focus in on the Rizhin Rebbe running away. So for example, we're going to talk about the fact, how do we get from Rizhin to the modern day evolution of that Chassidus, which is really Sadigur. So when you hear about Sadigur Chassidim, which are in Bnei Brak, so that is a descendant of the Rizhin Rebbe. And again, we'll see how exactly him running away leads him to that point in time. Of course, the entire story for us begins with the story of the Baal Shem Tov around 1730 in the 18th century. The Baal Shem Tov, of course, is the founder of Chassidim. He has a student who is the Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich, otherwise known as the Maggid of Mezrich. The Maggid of Mezrich is really the father of all Chassidus. So, for example, the Baal HaTanya, Rav Levi Yitzchak Miberdichev, all of them, are descendants of the Maggid of Mezrich. What's important to note is when we talk about Chassidus, so nowadays we talk about Chassidus in the sense that it's passed down from child to parent to parent to child to parent to child. It is a automatic dynasty. The first 100 years of Chassidus, that is not the way that things went. The first, The first 100 years, I'll get it, I'll be fine. The first 100 years of Chassidus is not passed down based on automatic dynasty, but rather it is a meritocracy. So
we'll see. It will work.
It'll work?
Yes.
Okay, what am I having? If I spit it out while I'm talking now, I apologize to the camera. Okay. So I gotta like wedge it in the side of my mouth now. It's like the baseball players are like chewing tobacco while they're... Thank you very much. Okay. It's important to recognize there was no automatic dynasty. Chassidus for the first 100 years or more was a meritocracy. So just because the father was a Chassidic Rebbe doesn't mean that the son was going to be a Chassidic Rebbe either. What it meant is that the best person was going to carry on the lineage of the Chassidus, and being the son of a Rebbe was no guarantee that you yourself would be a Rebbe. Now, of course, we'll see that that changes, and it's going to change around the time of the Rebbe of Rizhin, where many of his students become, and many of his children become, major figures in dynasties that we are going to be familiar to, but it's important to recognize that. What's also important to recognize, thank you so much, I appreciate it. Now I have to talk, drink, and suck at the same time. Okay, still in my mouth. We're good. Okay. At least my breath will smell good to the camera. It's important to remember also that Chassidus is not monolithic. Chassidus becomes very fragmented and very diverse. When we talk about Chassidus, there's not one Chassidus, but there's Chassidus that's going to be divided into many different parts depending on the type of Chassidus that you are following or that you are practicing. Most notably, when the Magen of Mezrich dies, there is a natural spin-off that you see within the Hasidic movement. Now, while we'll talk about it specifically within the context of the Hasidic movement, it's important to realize that this is a spin-off that takes place in other movements as well. So, for example, if we're talking about the Musar movement, we could talk about this type of spin-off as well. What am I mean, the spin-off? There are two fundamental approaches to how to live life as a Hasid. One is the ascetic approach, which means that this world means nothing. And because this world means nothing, I have no expectations from this world. Therefore, the Rebbe lives very humbly. The Rebbe is poverty-stricken. The Rebbe lives without heat. He doesn't need heat in the winter. The Rebbe is removed from this world completely. Famous examples of this is Rav Zusha of Hannibal. And because the world means nothing, so you don't need anything. Now again, in the Musar movement, you see examples of this as well. There were certain schools of Musar thought that specifically negated all joy and all pleasure of the world. And the Rebbe was supposed to be so humble that they were removed from that world. The other approach is the exact opposite. The other approach was one of royalty. This said that the Rebbe is a reflection of God. And if the Rebbe is a reflection of God, that means that you have to honor the Rebbe so much, because by honoring the Rebbe, you're really honoring God and His Torah. And so in this ideal, the Rebbe is not living in poverty. The Rebbe doesn't have no heat in the winter. The Rebbe isn't living humbly, but rather the exact opposite. In this model, the Rebbe is living with great splendor, with great royalty. Why? Not because the Rebbe needs it, but because the Rebbe is a reflection of Hashem and His Torah. So no matter how poor the Hasidim will be, and we know that in large parts of the world at that time, the Hasidim were very poor. Nonetheless, fundamentally they believed that their Rebbe should live an opulent, wealthy, regal, royal lifestyle, not because the Rebbe himself needs to benefit from the world, but because again, the Rebbe is a reflection of Hashem and His Torah. When we talk about the Magid of Mezrich dies, there's that natural spin-off. Some of his students become ascetic, in other words, removing themselves from the world. Other of his students take on that mantle of royalty. He has a son, and his son is called Rav Avram the Malach. Now, a Malach, his name itself, should be an indication to you of what type of Chassidus he is practicing. I'm just going to skip to a slide here. Hopefully, I know it's a little smaller, but hopefully you can see here. We have the Baal Shem Tov, we have the Magen of Mezrich, we have Rav Avram HaMalach. Rav Avram HaMalach was angelic. Angelic means that he's not from this world, which is why, again, he develops that name of a Malach. He has a son, and his son is Rav Shalom Shachna of Probisht. Again, I'm pronouncing that wrong. Rav Shalom Shachna has two sons. One is Rav Avram, and the other is Rav Yisrael. You'll notice, just by paying attention to the years, that there is a dark cloud hanging over this family where nobody lives until 40 years old. Most of them die by 35. They marry young and they die young. They fulfill their mission on this world and then they disappear from the scene. So Rav Shalom Shachna, Rav Avram Friedman, you'll see the years, dies very, very young. Rav Shalom Shachna, as opposed to the Malach, who was removed from the world, he was the exact opposite. And he believed that the Rebbe lives in splendor, that the Rebbe has a palace, and the Rebbe has an opulent court. And he believed that that's how you build Chassidus in the eyes of the people, not by projecting the Rebbe as someone who's humble and living in poverty and disheveled, but rather the exact opposite. That if you want the Rebbe to be a great figure, then the Rebbe has to act like a great figure. And therefore, there's, again, that opulence, that sense of regalness, that sense of royalty. Now, as happens, I've been told, children like to differ from their parents. So you'll notice that whereas the Malach is removed from the world, and his son, Rav Shalom Shachna, is the exact opposite, he believes in that sense of royalty, and he has two children. He has a son named Rav Avram, who's named after Rav Avram the Malach. He dies very young. And then he has another son. And that other son, again, if you read the history books, there's different formulations for how the exact lineage passes down. To my understanding, this is the most authentic version of it. And he has another son who becomes the Rebbe, and that is Rabbi Yisrael Friedman, otherwise known as the Regina Rebbe. The Regina Rebbe was 6 years old when his father passes away, and he becomes Rebbe at a very young age. He's born in 1796 into what we would call rabbinic hierarchy. It was a rabbinically elite family. So, for example, his uncle was Rav Mordechai of Chernobyl, the Chernobyl Rebbe. Of course, he comes from this whole lineage, going straight back to the Magen and Mezrich. That was Hasidic elite. He's 4 years old. The story is told that the Chernobyl Rebbe would already stand for him. That's how this aura that the Regina Rebbe carried amongst him. When his father dies, so again, his older brother becomes the Rebbe for a very short period of time. And then when he passes away, the Regina Rebbe becomes Rebbe at 16 years old. So he becomes married at 13, and he becomes the Rebbe at 16 years old, which was very common back then. Because if you were only living until 35 years old, well, you couldn't wait around to make your mark on the world and to build a family. Just to give a little bit of an example, by 1825, when the Apta Rav passes away, the Regina Rebbe, at a very young age, becomes the preeminent force for Jews in the Pale of the Settlement. He really becomes the king of all of Hasidus. He starts in a very small town before moving to the city of Regin. And again, we're going to talk about all of this area that we're going to talk about is under the Russian Tsar. Now, you'll notice on the bottom here, I have all of this. We're going to come back to this. But the reason why I did it this way is I want you to have at least a visual of how many streams of Hasidus is going to come from the Rebbe of Regin. He's going to have a son, Rav Avram Yaakov Friedman, who's going to be the first Rebbe of Sadi Gura. And then you see from here, you have all these different types of Hasidus. Let's just think some that might be more, I know it's hard to read, so I'll read some for you. Boyaner, you have Boyaner Hasidus. That is a descendant of the Regina Rebbe of the Sadi Gura Rebbe. Vizhnitz, Rimanov, Kharkov, right? All of these are forms of Hasidus, which should be a little bit more familiar to you. Some of these are less popular. I actually had to Google some of them. Many of them were Hasidus that had one or two Rebbes before their form of Hasidus either died out or blended in. Don't forget, so much of Hasidus perished in the Holocaust when the Rebbes perished as well. But I just share this with you to give you a little bit of a sense of how much of our contemporary modern-day Hasidus is a direct descendant or direct result from the Regina Rebbe. Let me just share with you a couple of quotes about the Regina Rebbe. He did not write a Sefer, which made researching this a lot of fun. There's an art scroll put out a book called The Palace of Regin, I believe it's called, but it's out of print, and no one I knew had it, so that was inaccessible to me. There's a scholarly work done about the Rebbe of Regin, but that was $90 on Amazon, so that wasn't going to happen. And then a lot of the works are, how do I say this without being condescending, but they're almost like miracle worker tales, which I really tried to shy away from. In other words, unless I found something that was well documented, I try not to share it with you. So if I found it in what I thought was a viable safer, I felt comfortable sharing with you tonight, but I really tried to stay away from some of the more like miraculous Rebbe type stuff that certainly I was unable to validate. But here's a couple quotes. This is from a safer Migdal David, who said, "You should be amongst those who stand before him to wash his feet and drink from his wells. Since I had the vision in 1840 that he is truly our king, the Mashiach, and that he possesses the soul of the Baal Shem Tov, and you cannot fathom his greatness and his highness as perceived in the high court of heavenly Jerusalem, where all fear him and seek his well-being. The verse, Israel about whom I assume will boast, can be applied to him, and the entire world is not sufficiently qualified to express even a drop in the ocean of his praise." You have it in Hebrew there as well from the exact Sefer. Again, unless I could validate it from the Sefer, I did not quote it for you. So you get the sense very quickly that there's this aura, there's this charisma that the Regina Rebbe has that's drawing people in, that is magnetic, that's almost tangible and palpable to anyone who meets him. Here's another quote, this from the Sefer Abir Yaakov, where he writes, if I were to live for even 1,000 years on a desert island without even a single holy book at hand, I would not be distracted even for a moment from my closeness to God. That's a description of the Regina Rebbe, a quote from him. So again, just to give you a little bit of a sense of the type of person that he is. We know that he had great organizational skills, and we know that from the fact that he attracts thousands of Hasidus. He is a person who has a reputation of someone who understands people. He definitely has a reputation a little bit as a miracle worker, and he welcomes everybody. Everyone is drawn to his court, Jews, non-Jews. They're all coming for blessings. They're all coming for favors. Included in that are many great Hasidic Rebbeim, even those who disagreed fundamentally with his approach. So, for example, there's a very famous story about the Chidushei Arim, where the Chidushei Arim comes to visit him, but he disguises himself, and the Regina Rebbe immediately recognizes him and says, it's so great to see you. He said, how'd you know me? He said, I felt the aura, I felt the Kedusha emanating from you, and that's how I knew that it was you. But all the great Rebbes came to visit him, and during his life, he was known as really the king of all of Hasidus. He pioneers, and this is central to our understanding of the rest of the class, he pioneers approach in Hasidus, which we touched upon a little bit earlier, but he really takes it to the next level. And that approach is what we'll call Derech HaMalchus, which means the way of royalty, right? A certain nobility, a certain regal splendor about him. Now that's not just the way he carries himself, but that applies to everything about him. So whether it is his clothing, whether it's his palatial home, whether it's the opulence and the impressive magnificence of his carriage, he was described to have had a chariot with 4 white horses, countless servants, a throne that was made of gold in an opulent palace. Now, some of you might be sitting there and thinking, that doesn't seem very Rebbe-like, right? For the Rebbe to have so much opulence and royalty and regalness and magnificence and wealth, right? But again, that's why we started off with. There were 2 schools in Hasidic thought. One of them said that the Rebbe is a reflection of God. And therefore, if the Rebbe is a reflection of God, so he has to act that way and behave that way and be viewed that way. That shouldn't be foreign to us. Again, let's take an example from the Mussar movement. So in the Mussar movement, you had Navardic Mussar, which believed in Shiflas Adam, believed in humility. So for example, if you were in the Navardic school of Mussar, you might go into a hardware store and ask for a tuna fish sandwich. And the reason why you would do that is so the guy would laugh at you and you would feel the humiliation and you would recognize that this world is really nothing of importance. On the other hand, we know that there was Slabodka Mussar. Slabodka Mussar was the exact opposite. It believed in godless Adam, the greatness of mankind. And because mankind was so great, so if you came from the Slabodka school of thought, which, by the way, most American Rosh Yeshiva are descendants from that mindset, well, you had to act a certain way, and you had to dress in a certain proper way. You had to conduct yourself in a certain way. After all, if you are a reflection of Torah, so you have to appear that way as well. We have halachas like that. For example, a melech, a king, has certain halachas about how they're supposed to conduct themselves. The melech, the king, has to be wealthier than everybody else, and smarter than everybody else, and stronger than everyone else, and bigger than everyone else. Why? Because the melech is representative of the Jewish people. He's representative of God. And therefore, he has to conduct himself in a certain way. We have halachas by a Talmud Chacham. The halacha of a Talmud Chacham is that Talmud Chacham shouldn't have stains on his clothing. They should carry themselves with a certain dignity. A Talmud Chacham is not supposed to walk in the street while eating something or drinking something because, again, it's pasnish. It's not becoming of someone who is a representative of Torah. So we have halachas like that, and we have examples of it in other Jewish thought. And that's why I share that with you, because it's just important to recognize the Regina Rebbe takes that to the next level, but it's not unheard of. It's not without precedent that the Regina Rebbe is living this type of a lifestyle. Now, there's another very important figure at that moment. Here, let's just, what I miss here. Okay, right, another quote from the Regina Rebbe. Believe me that I am a part of the Jewish soul, and if one Jew from another part of the end of the world is pained, I feel it immediately. That sounds very Rebbish, right? That the Rebbe cares about everybody, that he bears the pain of other people as well. Okay. Oh, here's another one. Again, lest you think that he takes the pleasure of the world and enjoys it. This is a quote from Igros Rav Meiruzhin Uvanov. It's a testimony of one of his disciples where he says that the Rishina Rebbe used to raise his hand. Asher kodem p'tiras maran Meiruzhin tafas b'sara achas mipeos av. He used to grab his hair. Ve'amar, and he said, Ribono Shalola, Master of the Universe, galoi v'yadua lifanecha, shelo ne'enesi me'olam hazeh k'mali nima, that I didn't benefit from this world whatsoever. So lest you think he enjoyed the opulence, no. That was what we call in learning terms a heichi timsa. It's a means to an end. He's a reflection of God. He has to express that royalty. But don't think for a second that he himself benefited from it. When we talk about the geography, so here's just a, I know you can't obviously see these words, but you can see this is Rishin. You have the Ukraine, Moldova, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia. This is going to be Austria. This is going to be Russia. Right here is the river that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. Rolling over all of this, of all of Russia at the time, is Tsar Nicholas I, otherwise known as the Iron Tsar. Now, there's a reason they don't call me the Iron Rebbe, the Iron Rabbi, right? Both because, right, I know my build really gives that away, but more importantly, I'm a nice guy, right? So if you have the word iron in your name, that should be pretty telling about the type of person that you are. So the Iron Tsar, Tsar Nicholas I, was not a good guy, certainly did not like Jews very much whatsoever. In 1823, he passes a series of very harsh decrees. Much of these decrees are dedicated to destroying Judaism. So for example, there was the Cantonist Decree, which might be familiar to some of us. The Cantonist Decree said that children as young as 8, certainly by the age of 12 years old, are taken from their homes, and they're essentially indoctrinated in Russian culture. They're prepared for the army so that at the age of 18, they can go into the Russian army where they're going to serve for 25 years. Many of the stories that we know of Rebbes, of Rosh Yeshiva, was trying to protect and prevent young Jewish boys from being drafted into the Russian army. That was not a place that you wanted to be. So when you got taken out of your home at 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and you were drawn into the Russian army, this Cantonist decree, you had no hope of being Jewish. Your education was cut off. You were indoctrinated with Russian language, with Russian culture, with Russian ideology. And then you spent the next 25 years in the Russian army. That's the quickest, easiest way to cut off Judaism, when you take the children and you prevent them from learning about Judaism. Now, we know about this because even though this was manifest at the beginning of the 19th century, we know it rears its ugly head again in the 20th century, right? When the Russians, the Soviet Union, in the middle of the 20th century, prevent Jews from practicing Judaism. And they shut down yeshivas, and they shut down schools, and they try to cut off the education. So again, that was just a modern a formulation of the same idea of what Tsar Nicholas I tried to do. Another way that they tried to oppress the Jewish people was an elaborate system of informers. Informers are, again, the older version of what we would call the KGB. In the same way, again, I wasn't there, but there are very famous stories in the former Soviet Union, when you used to show up at shul, and there's a guy at the door who used to ask you if you had a Hebrew name. Those were KGB agents. They were trying to weed out those who were studying Judaism. So back then, in the 19th century as well, you had informers. And informers were there for two reasons. Either they fundamentally believed they were saving Judaism. So you had maskilim. You had those who were reformists, those who were trying to modernize Judaism, who truly felt that the best thing for Judaism was to quote-unquote force the Hasidim into modernization. And so one of the ways they did that was they said, we're going to force you to dress like a Russian, and we're going to force you to speak like a Russian, and the way that we're going to do that is we're going to rat you out. So if you're trying to open up yeshivas, if you're trying to educate your children, if you're trying to practice your Judaism, we're going to tell on you. And we're going to get you into trouble, obviously, I'm using very soft language, and we're going to force you to give up your Judaism. That was one group of informers, and we're going to come back to that group in a little bit. The other group of informers were simple gangsters, right? What's an easy way to make money? An easy way to make money is blackmail. the oldest job in the world, but I'm pretty sure that's not the case, right? So blackmail. So what's an easy way to do blackmail? Well, I can come up to you. I can go up to Rabbi Goldberg and say, you know, Rabbi, either you pay me off or I'm going to go to the Russian government and tell them about everything that you're doing. And so there was this, it was a very lucrative business to extort money from the Jewish community. And because the Jewish community didn't want these informers to rat them out, so they simply paid them out. All of that is a backdrop to the Ushitz affair, as it's referred to, which applies in around 1836, a little bit before that, when there are two informers who are informing the Russian government about the Jews, particularly in our case, the Rebbe of Rzhin. Now you can imagine that if the Rebbe of Rzhin is very wealthy, what do the Russians want to get their hands on? They want some of that wealth. Here they see that these Hasidim are treating their Rebbe like a king. He has the palace and the horses and the chariots and the opulence and the royalty. And they say, we want a piece of that. So that attracts the attention and the ire of Tsar Nicholas I. There were two informers of the government, Yitzchak Oxman and Shmuel Schwartzman, who are terrorizing the Jews. And the Jews have to pay them off. It is essentially protection money. Because if you don't pay them off, then they're going to inform on you and you're going to be sent to prison. Now, in Jewish law, we have a word for people like that. What is the word? Moser. Right? A moser. We have halachas about a moser. And so, as the story goes, the Jewish community rids themselves of these moserim, and essentially they have them killed. One of them is killed in the mikvah, the other is dropped into the river, and the police all of a sudden wake up one morning and wonder what happened to these informers. After all, who's losing out right now? The police, the government. It's a steady stream of income when the Jewish community is paying them off. All of a sudden, the informers disappear and the Jewish community isn't paying off anybody anymore, and the police want to know what is going on. 2 years go by, they can't find anything until what happens? We see all the movies. When you drop the body in the river, what happens to the body? It washes up eventually. And that's exactly what happens. The body washes up and the police want to know what in the world happened. Well, there was a third reformer. Not exactly sure, depending on which I was reading. It's either this guy Kenigsberg or this guy Joseph Pearl. But anyways, he is the third informer, and he writes a letter to Tsar Nicholas, who is, of course, obsessed with destroying the Jews, obsessed with anti-Semitism, and he writes a letter linking the Regina Rebbe to the murder of these two people. The Rebbe, all of a sudden, finds himself in a precarious situation, because what the informer is telling Tsar Nicholas I is that all of the Rebbe's money should really belong to you. Why are the Jews giving the money to their Rebbe when in fact they should be paying it as taxes to you, the king? And so in 1838, the Rebbe is arrested along with 80 other Jews. Six of them are flogged to death. The others are sent to Siberia. And the Rebbe is sent to Kiev. He is placed in prison in Kiev for 22 months, just about 2 years. That's Tsar Nicholas, Yimach Shmo V'zichro. And here we come to the great escape. The Rebbe is in Kiev for 22 months, where he's placed in solitary confinement, and the Hasidim move heaven and earth to protect and to free their Rebbe. They're finally allowed to have a shamish come in and to learn with the Rebbe, to have kosher food brought in, to allow the Rebbe access to certain religious books, and they're trying everything. They're bribing. They try to appeal to Montefiore to place international pressure that the Rebbe should be released. After 22 months, on the 15th day of Adar, which of course is Shushan Purim, 1840, the Rebbe is released, not because Tsar Nicholas is nice, but rather because of external pressure. Now, one of the rules is that he can't go back to being the Rebbe of thousands of people. And it was told to the Rebbe that the plan was that Tsar Nicholas was going to exile him to Siberia. Siberia is not where you want to be, and Siberia is not a place where Rebbe is going to attract his thousands and thousands of Hasidim. And so the Rebbe recognizes that he has to run away. First, he runs to Kishinev, and then ultimately, he runs out of Russia into Austria. Now, how do we know about this escape? There's not a lot known to us until several years ago. And that's what makes it fascinating. So you see here, I have all these questions that were never answered. How did the Rebbe obtain the proper documents? When he comes to Austria, he's detained by the Austrian officials, and they interrogate him for a number of weeks. Right? Why wasn't he deported back to Russia? How did the Rebbe end up coming to Sadigor? How do we know all of this? And how do we know what happened? So about a number of years ago, 2-3 years ago, Kedem Auction House received an entire binder full of documents relating to the escape of the Regina Rebbe. And much of what we know nowadays about the escape, about the interrogation, the travel documents, the names, the aliases, who traveled alongside with him, is a result of this find. So here you have, this was an article, famed Hasidic rabbi's daring escape from Tsarist Russia revealed in rare file. That's a copy of the book. Here you have something, but that's his. The reason why I brought it is because on the bottom is his signature. You see Israel, right? So you have his signature. This is obviously a treasure trove. Anyone want to guess how much it sold for? $260,000. I actually thought that was low. I don't know. Mickey Mantle's baseballs go for millions of dollars. So the Regina Rebbe's. So you should go for that amount of money as well. But a lot of what we know comes from that. I have a couple of slides just to show you. This is the passport that was used. These are examples of the travel document. Again, you have his name under there. Now you see it says Yisrael, but underneath it says Donenfeld. Hold that for a second, because we're going to come back to that name. Now, why is this so important? Why would someone pay $250,000, $250,000 for this manuscript? So I have here, from again, Igros Rav Mirujin Uvanov, in the introduction, he writes the following. Chassidim ascribe paramount importance to a letter or copying written and signed by our holy rabbis, whether dictated or written, if only in their name. However, the value of an original holy letter bearing their original signature is immeasurable, and they safeguard it very carefully and hand it down from father to son, from generation to generation. With awe and a sense of holiness, they treat them as secular items. That was not supposed to be secular, I assume. And as amulets for protection and success. Right? Kechefze segula v'kmiya. Yeah, not secular. It was skula items, and it auto-corrected it. So skula items and amulets for protection. Here you have as well, it is known that when Rav Shmuel Heller, who was a rabbi in Tzfat, went to sleep, he would place his head on a letter signed by the Rebbe of Rizhin for protection. So obviously, if you're a chassid of the Rizhina Rebbe, if you're a chassid of Sadigur or of Rimanov or of Bayaner, right? So now, all of a sudden, they find the signature of your Rebbe. That obviously is a big deal. So much of what I'm going to tell you tonight is what was found in this treasure trove, which actually makes it a fascinating conversation, because it means that much of what we know certainly is within the last number of years, and it was filled in the blanks, a lot of what had existed previously. So what do we know? We know that the Hasidim pay off government officials, and he's able to go to Romania and finally to Austria. He travels without his family. When the Regina Rebbe is running away, his family is left back in Russia. He misses the weddings of two of his children as a result of what happens. He departs on. Now, this is crazy. You want to talk about Hashkacha Pratis? Which Parsha do you think he departs on? Parshas Bo, Bishalach, somewhere in there, January 15th, 1842, which is this Shabbos. So it was fortuitous that I didn't give the class last week, and instead gave it this week because we're commemorating the exact date that the Regina Rebbe runs away. Now, why does this work that he runs from Russia to Austria without getting too much into European history? I'm sure the last time you guys studied that was probably like a college, maybe an AP course, right? AP Euro, that was like a big thing. But anyways, Russia and Austria didn't like each other very much. And so when the Regina Rebbe comes to Austria, they are more than happy, so to speak, to stick it, to be nice, to stick it to the Tsar Nicholas and to keep the Rebbe in Austria. And it's in Austria, it's in that area, that he is able to rebuild in Sadigur with the palace and the horses and the opulence. And that is where you find today the Sadigur Chasidus, which again is largely centralized in Bnei Brak, in Eretz Yisrael. You have all of the various dynasties that come from Sadigur. That was the original chart that I gave you at the beginning. When he travels, there is a travel document, again, that's found in the treasure trove. There's a travel document that's issued to Michal Goldenthal, who is accompanied by the Rebbe, who is registered as Michal's brother, and two other individuals, one Judel Fischel and Shmiel Baer. Shmiel Baer is the wagon driver. They arrive in Sadigur on the first day of Adar, the first day of Adar, 1842, which is 2 years after he's taken into prison the first time. Now, how does he stay in Austria? Right? We know he's interrogated for a number of weeks when he arrives in Austria. What legal footing does he have to stay in Austria and not be deported back to Russia? So that's where this document comes into play. If you remember, I said you have Yisrael, but then you have a name there, Donenfeld. Who was Yisrael Donenfeld? Yisrael Donenfeld's a very tragic story. Was a young boy, the son of Hertz and Fagi Donenfeld, who disappeared at the age of 8 years old. Disappeared at the age of 8 years old 40 years ago, which just happens to match up, not exactly, but enough, to the age of the Regina Rebbe. And so when the Regina Rebbe comes to Austria, the Hasidim instruct him to take on the identity of Yisrael Donenfeld and to claim that what happened is that he was orphaned at a very young age. He went to live with his rich uncle, Shalom Friedman, in Regin. And now he's coming home to Austria. He's coming home to where he grew up to lay claim to, I don't know, whatever, to come back to the homeland. And therefore, if that's the case, then he is an Austrian citizen. And if you're an Austrian citizen, what are you not going to be? You are not going to be extradited back to Russia. And that's exactly what happens. And again, that's why you have the name here, Yisrael Donenfeld, because that is the alias under which the Rebbe of Regin comes to Austria. The Montefiore puts enormous pressure on Russia for 2 years. His family is unable to join him. Finally, they are reunited and they have six sons and a daughter. Those six sons and a daughter all become, as we saw earlier, all become various rebbeim of different chassidus. Now, why does that happen? Why aren't they all just Regina rebbeim or Sadigur rebbeim? Because at this point, it gets passed down to the son, which means only one person can become the first Rebbe of Sadigur, which means the other ones have to start their own chassidus depending on where they end up, which is why you have Boyan, and you have Vizhnitz, and you have Rimanov, and you have Kharkov. You have all these places which are cities where the sons end up, and that's why you have all these various forms of chassidus. Now, the Regina Rebbe, in addition to building in Sadigur, also is very involved in building Israel. And so when Nissim Beck, our guest on Behind the Bima last week, you know where my head is already directed, right? Nissim Beck, a very wealthy merchant who came to Aliyah when no one else did, and he hears that the Russian government wants to purchase a very large area in Jerusalem, so he contacts the Regina Rebbe. The Regina Rebbe buys the land and builds the famous Tiferes Yisrael Synagogue, which is right here. It's right near the Chorvashul in the Old City, and it was destroyed in 1948, I believe, 48, by the Jordanians. Now, it's rebuilt nowadays, not in that same location, although I heard recently they're starting to rebuild it, right. But they actually built a new Tiferes Yisrael. Tiferes Yisrael, obviously, we now understand the context of the name. Yisrael is the one who paid for it, the Regina Rebbe. Why Tiferes? What does the word Tiferes mean? Glory. It's the glory of Yisrael. Again, that sense of royalty, that sense of magnificence, that sense of regalness. So it's the Tiferes Yisrael Shul. There's another Tiferes Yisrael Shul.
When was that one?
This one? This is in the 19th century. Again, it's destroyed by the Jordanians. And I read somewhere, that they're trying to rebuild it nowadays. But it's in the old city of Yerushalayim. There's another Tiferes Yisrael Shul, which is this one. You'll notice it has that same dome because they tried to mimic the original version of it. This is where the Boyaner Chassidim. Now you understand why Boyaner Chassidim are doing a shul, the Tiferes Yisrael, because again, they come from the Rishin lineage, the Rishin dynasty. And this today is found right near, right behind, actually, the central bus station. So, if you walk from the central bus station behind it towards Gula, that is where you'll find this monstrosity, the Boyaner Shul. The Rebbe dies in 1850. His eldest son dies 10 years later, and Rav Avram Yaakov of Sadigur builds into an even greater Chassidus, which again exists to this very day. In fact, we have a member of our community who moved in over the pandemic. I had him over for a meal the other week, and I was talking to him, and he told me he just got back from Bnei Brak. I said, "Oh, what are you doing in Bnei Brak?" He said, "I went to ask my Rebbe a question." I said, "Oh, you went to ask your Rebbe a question? You went all the way to Eretz Yisrael. They have phones, right? We have FaceTime now. They're great things." I said, "Who's your Rebbe?" So he's a chassid of Sadi Gur. He grew up, he went he considers himself a chassid of the Regina Rebbe, of the Sadi Gur Rebbe, and of Sadi Gur Chassidus. And so because he's a real disciple of the Sadi Gur Chassidus, so he says that whenever he does business deals, whenever he's about to embark on a major journey, so he goes and he asks the Sadi Gur Rebbe for a bracha. He travels, or he's gone to Europe to visit all the kvarim and all the old places of the Chassidim, but I didn't have a full appreciation at the time when he was describing it, but now I have a much greater appreciation. Two takeaway points while wrapping up. Number one is I want, hopefully you have an appreciation of just how much danger Jews were in. Not just how much danger Jews were in, but specifically how much danger Rebbes were in, Rosh Yeshivas were in, right? You think about the Netziv and the Velaz and Yeshiva. You think about what we just talked about, the Regina Rebbe. Even when they come to Sadi Gur, right? They were targets. And there was a real threat of blackmail. There was a real threat of extortion. There was a real threat of imprisonment. And nobody was off limits. So even though you were the great Regina Rebbe, nonetheless, you were in, you had that palace and the chariot and the horses and the servants and all of the opulence in the world. Nobody was immune to the danger of the Russian government, of the secular government at the time, who again would do anything to A, kill Jews, B, extort Jews, blackmail them, and get money from them. The other thing I want, hopefully we'll appreciate from tonight, is again this chart at the beginning of just how central Rishin is to Chassidus as we experience it nowadays. Again, just saying the names of Vizhnitz and Ribbonov and Sadi Gur and Kharkov and Boyaner. These are major, major, major Hasidic movements in this day and age. And now we at least have a little bit of an appreciation of where they came from, how they evolved, and really the miraculousness of it. There was a time in history where it was not for granted that the Regina Rebbe would be alive, that he would be able to rebuild his Chassidus, and that's the great miracle of the story, is that not only is the Regina Rebbe able to escape, but he's able to rebuild even stronger in Sadi Gur, ultimately immigrating to Eretz Yisrael and building a very vibrant Chassidus in Bnei Brak to this very day. That is the story of Yisrael Friedman of Rishin. That is the story of his great escape, which again, we know more about now than I'd be given this class 5 years ago, which to me is fascinating and just shows you how we're constantly evolving. I don't know who purchased the manuscripts from Kedem Auction House, but I would love to meet him. I would love to see it and have him make a donation to BRS as well. It actually caused me, you know, I was on the website, so I'm a direct descendant of the Chai Adam. I said, I wonder, you know, maybe they have a manuscript from the Chai Adam. And then I saw the price point. I said, someone else will, another member of the Mishpacha will take care of purchasing that, and maybe I'll get to see that one today. But again, hopefully an appreciation of just how precarious this situation was for the Rebbes, for the Jews in the 19th century, how dangerous it was to be beholden to the anti-Semitism and the hatred of the governments around them, and B, the miraculousness of the survival of the Regina Rebbe, of his escape to Sadigur, and of all of the streams of Hasidus that emerged as a result of this great escape. With that, I wish everyone a great evening.